there is nuance in how funding periods can apply. 3 months is not a hard rule. You can have a funding period up to 12 months.
I think the agency and indeed the ombudsman that has a role in overseeing the service guarantee, I think there needs to be a very sharp eye on change of circumstance processing by the agency, because this is all about the ebb and flow of support, and disability is inherently unpredictable.
But I think the rigidity and the hard and fast rules are not going to get us the NDIS that Australia has been so proud of. We need the nuance. We need to remember that there are individuals behind every single decision that the agency makes.
Hi, I'm Dr. George Talaporis, and welcome to Visual and Necessary, Australia's period podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, make sure you subscribe to the channel and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. On this episode, we dive deep into funding periods and support lists, two of the biggest changes happening right now in the NDIS. We sit down with two expert lawyers to understand what the law says and what needs to change. Check it out. Hey, Darren and Sian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both on. How about we start with some introductions? Can I start with you, Darren?
I'm senior lecturer at Latrobe Law School, and I really just focus on public administration, bureaucracy, and the detailed rules in our social security system and in disability policy. So the more detailed and boring, the better for me.
Right. Thanks, Darren. Sian.
Thanks, George. Yeah, so my name's Sian Thomas, and I'm the Principal Solicitor at Queensland Advocacy for Inclusion in Queensland. And we work with participants when they want to review an NDIS decision in the Administrative Review Tribunal. So we speak to lots of participants working through both internal reviews and external reviews.
Amazing. So we've got like the administrative side, and we've got what's happening on the ground. There's lots happening in the NDIS right now, so many things. I'm excited to have you both to help us understand them from a legal perspective. We're going to tackle two rather controversial changes, and we're going to start with funding periods. So, Darren, I'll start with you. For people that don't know, what are funding periods?
Well, the 2024 Act gave a new power to the agency to set up funding periods for every NDIS plan. And a funding period is basically a way of staging the release of the total budget for the plan. So it can be any amount of time up to a year. And you can have an NDIS plan that releases funding every 4 months, 1 month under the law. Okay. Now, the agency has begun a rollout of funding periods very recently. Until May, every NDIS plan was set at annual, effectively, that the standard period for newly built plans was always going to be 1 year. Now, we are entering an era where in every planning meeting, a set of funding periods will be designed. And the law, which is a set of rules that were created alongside the support rules that we'll talk about later in the podcast, the law has a range of considerations as to how funding periods are to be designed. Some of them are obviously agency issues, where the agency has concern that a person might overutilize their funding and leave themselves without funding towards the end of the plan. Importantly, there are two factors that every participant can appeal to in asking for the maximum flexibility. Their preference. So every participant gets to go to their planning meeting and express their preference about how they want their NDIS funds released, how frequently. And secondly, a participant can say to the agency, that doesn't work for me because it is a risk for me. I think I'm going to have more flexibility because maybe my carer is under particular pressure at particular times of the year and I can't lean on informal support. Maybe the participant has experiences in the past of experiencing increased needs at particular times due to fluctuating disability. So it's very important that funding periods can't be generic. They have to be genuine decisions about the person's situation. While the agency can have a sort of general approach, okay, we've heard conversations about 3 months being sort of standard, that can only be a kind of starting point for a conversation because the law says the agency has the power to divide up your funding and release it in each funding period, but you have to have a conversation with the agency and the agency has to engage with the participant around how long that period should be.
Stan, you're working on the ground. Based on what Darren just said, is that how the funding periods are being rolled out? Are being people having flexible conversations about what their funding periods are going to look like?
Thanks, George. Look, we are definitely starting to see these new plans roll out with the funding periods, and I've seen a combination of two different types. One's where the funding period is for a 1 month period, so all of the funding has been divided into a 1 month, sort of a 12 month split into 12 funding periods, and we're also seeing the 3 month funding period. Our impression is that these plans are coming a little bit as a surprise to people because it is quite a new thing that the agency has started. But we absolutely know that if you ask, certainly in our case, when we're working with the agency in our tribunal processes, we are asking and being quite proactive about the funding periods that would be appropriate for the client. I do think there's probably some things being ironed out by the agency still. So I've seen a few things which absolutely wouldn't work. For example, positive behaviour support funding is something that generally should be spent kind of a fairly topic, like it should be spent early in the plan. So the intention is that it can be used once the plan's in place or that can be rolled out as the year goes on. I've certainly seen a plan where it's been divided up quite equally over a 12-month period into 12-month slots, and that means that a positive behaviour support practitioner really has their hands tied at the beginning of that plan period because they can't access those other fees. With the funding periods, I think it's really important for participants to know that it's not a use it or lose it. So you use it, you get your 3 months. If you don't spend all of it in that 3 months, the amount that you didn't spend does roll over into the second 3 months. And where I see an advantage for funding periods into the future is really for the longer plan. So if your needs are really stable and you can see that you could have a three-year plan, that you would have 3 12-month funding periods, and that's, you know, got some really great advantages to it because it does mean a participant has a longer plan and more security in how that might work over the longer period. I'll probably just say one other thing about the funding periods. It does make me nervous. It makes me really nervous for the participants that we particularly work with who generally do come to us because they are chronically underfunded. For whatever reason, there hasn't been the plan that the agency does need to be nimble enough to respond quickly to those circumstances. And my fear is just at the moment, it's not quite nimble enough. Yeah.
So what's your advice if someone attends a planning session and they find out that the planner has allocated a our funding period that's
too restrictive,
too short to work for them.
So we would say funding periods are reviewable in the same way that the supports in your plan is reviewable and the management of your plan is reviewable. So say you get a plan, it doesn't have the supports you need, or the one of the funding periods is too restrictive. So again, we might see parents who want to sort of use a bit extra in the school holidays and then of their capacity building budget and then go a bit light during the school term. That is a reviewable decision and it can be reviewed through to the internal review process and ultimately to the tribunal. I certainly hope we wouldn't get too many at the tribunal, but it is something you can review, and I would encourage participants to, one, make sure they understand what they want their funding periods to be when they're going into their planning meeting, and to, you know, if it's really not going to work, think about your review rights.
And that's really interesting. I'm wondering, though, how long might it take for the review to happen? Because I'm thinking, if it takes 3 months or 4 months, it's not going to solve the problem, is it?
No, that's absolutely right, George. I would say, you know, the internal review process, I think it is speeding up. We have seen some it move a little bit faster than perhaps what we saw 18 months ago. I would certainly hope that really sensible decisions would start to be made at that internal review stage. And so you could get that solved within 1 or 2, possibly 3 months. But yes, once you're at the tribunal, you would be looking at about 6 months at minimum to resolve something like this.
And can I say, George, as well, that for those who the plan rolls and they don't have, you know, they've timed out of their right to appeal the original plan decision, you know, a lot of people will be thinking about change of circumstances. So if you have someone with a degenerative condition and their needs are picking up, there's no doubt that funding periods will have this effect where people will need to lean into the change of circumstances process earlier, and they'll be relying a lot more on the change of circumstance forms and business process. And the most recent quarterly report for the agency was very concerning in terms of the participant service guarantee being down as low as 23% compliance with the expected timeline for a change of circumstance decision. So I think the agency, and indeed the ombudsman that has a role in overseeing the service guarantee, I think there needs to be a very sharp eye on change of circumstance processing by the agency, because this is all about the ebb and flow of support, and disability is inherently unpredictable. You can set up a plan and, you know, 6-9 months down the road, someone's informal support has utterly changed, someone's needs have gone up. There's going to be this easily predictable demand on an area that is statistically very under pressure.
Absolutely. We have a lot of planners that listen to our podcast. What advice would you give to them in terms of how they should be implementing funding periods?
Yeah, so I think with the funding periods, absolutely speak to the participant about what is going on for them. And I think it's not a one-size-fits-all. So just because you have a funding period for your core support, you may very well have a different funding period for your other supports in there. So we do see already, and this is absolutely correct, is that all the sort of assistive technology, home improvements and whatnot are all front-loaded into the first funding period. So that's there, and it can sit there for the life of the plan. So that there is nuance in how funding periods can apply. We've definitely, 3 months is not a hard rule. As Darren's pointed out, you can have a funding period up to 12 months. So where there is a lot of flux in a participant's capacity or changes happening, that maybe a 12-month plan may be appropriate for them in those circumstances. We definitely have had plans approved with 6-month funding periods, so they're available. And yeah, just applying a bit more nuance, I think, for participants' circumstances is absolutely available to you in the legislation and can be done.
Absolutely. And the NDIS Act says that things are meant to be individualised, and I think that the rule around this really asks the planner and the delegate to look at the individual situation and apply a period that's appropriate for that person. Thanks both of you so much for helping us unpack the funding periods. I'd like to now turn to the infamous NDIS support list. And Darren, the review promised participants more flexibility and choice over our supports. How did we end up with a set of in and out lists that are quite restrictive when it comes to what you can and can't spend your funding on?
Well, I think firstly, I'm going to say that I have a lot of opinions about these lists, and I certainly want to see change. But your question sort of asks me to set up what is the public administration issue that these lists are trying to fix. Okay, so part of my role as an academic is to state the other side's perspective pretty fairly. Okay, so I'll do that. Okay. If we think back to the start of the scheme, the agency was provided with a computer system, which was described as the minimum viable product by the Department of Human Services. Bear in mind that that was the department that happily launched the Robodebt computer system. And up until 2023, the first 10 years of the scheme, the agency has told its minister that there were catastrophic weaknesses in how invoices were reviewed, whether they were reviewed at all, how payments were accepted. And what happened in 2023 was an agenda effectively which responded to fears around the need to check how NDIS payments are signed off on. Now, legally, an NDIS support, you only have to confirm a couple of things about an NDIS support for it to be constitutional or for it to be something that the federal government can pay out. So it needs to be implementing a specific obligation of the UN Convention. It needs possibly to fit the constitutional idea of a sickness benefit. But broadly, the concern of the agency in bringing forward these lists was the practical reality that this agency accepts 400,000 claims a day. And they wanted a simpler set of rules to administer. One of the issues that the NDIS rules that defined what an NDIS support could be, one of the issues as the agency saw it, was that they were very general and they would require checking. So they permitted participants, for instance, in a case called Deaton, which was recently in the federal court, participants could claim for disability-related electricity costs. Now, the agency were uncomfortable with that because their view was, how do we administer an invoice that's for electricity? How do we as bureaucrats confirm that that electricity went on disability and not on non-disability? And so what produced these lists ultimately is an extraordinary defensive anxiety around checking. Checking. And in 2024, in a very rushed process, new lists were brought in to allow the agency to operate on bright line categories. And I guess the story we're going to tell in the rest of the podcast is how bright line lists often endanger outcomes. They miss important realities for people with disability, and they see them go without needed support. And ultimately, I'm not interested in spending tons of time recriminating over these lists, but I do think there are some really important changes that need to happen. And one of the saddest things I think that has happened is what we're starting to call the disability shop. That because the agency wants a bright line definition, people can no longer go to a shop that every Australian goes to and purchase, using some examples from the tribunal, purchase a stovetop that has really useful features like audio when it is turned up and down to protect the person from burning their hands. Okay, they can no longer buy standard things and put them to disability focused uses. And that's an enormous damaging thing for people with disability. It runs counter to universal design and inclusive equality. And it's something that we need to see stopped, you know, but we're only getting started on the damage the lists have caused, I think.
I love that example. I've had lots of different examples where the mainstream product solves a disability problem, and in doing so, it does it at a really affordable price. But if you buy it from the disability shop and an OT has designed it for you, suddenly the cost of that same product becomes quite astronomical, and then it's fundable by the NDIS. So there are some very perverse incentives that have come out of these lists. Sian, you are seeing some of the repercussions on the ground. Can you talk us through some of the things that you're seeing from the Section 10 list? And I think this is going to be really helpful because the lists are currently under review. So I know that there are people in the department listening to this podcast who are going to want to know what are some of the problems that you're seeing on the ground.
Yeah, thank you, George, and Darren also for that introduction and that background, which is really helpful, because absolutely we're seeing less flexibility for participants on the ground, and we're also seeing there's not only the lists, but it's also the behaviours that it drives by participants, the support coordinators and the plan managers as well, because of a fear that is created that if you don't buy your support from, as Darren says, and you say, a sort of a disability support provider, that you might not get your invoice paid. And so it is driving some behaviours there, I think, within the broader community. And some of the examples that we've come across in our practice, you know, short-term accommodation or respite, really valuable support, especially for adult children still living with their parents, really key kind of support that they need to access. And what we're seeing is where there might have been some flexibility in how respite might happen, and it might include, you know, going out and staying at an Airbnb with their support worker and using a sort of an itemized expenses on what's spent through that respite, there is a fear that that can't be funded anymore and you need to go to a disability short-term accommodation provider and kind of be packaged up. So we think, you know, that's taking away, which is awful. It's taking away flexibility and choice and control for participants.
Is it fair to say that it's also more expensive?
Like absolutely, yeah.
I'm thinking of the pricing for some of these disability respite providers and they are astronomical.
Absolutely. So, yes, there's the price guide has a price for what a short-term accommodation should be on a nightly basis. If a participant and their family have a creative way of doing a respite, which, you know, provides the space from parents that is required for each, the participant and the parents, and also an opportunity to be out in the community learning new things, it's generally much more cost effective. So that's one example. We're certainly seeing it in the consumable space where people will go to the big NDIS registered sort of providers for those things instead of perhaps a chemist or one of the big supermarkets where you might be able to get those items cheaper. The other area that's really concerning to us, especially here in Queensland, is air conditioning. You know, that's an item that has been stated as being a standard household item. I'm looking at Darren here because I know there's a little bit of tribunal law around it. That's absolutely a problem for participants who have thermoregulation that that they can't have air conditioning through the plans. Yeah.
Can I bring Darren in then on that? Because Darren, there was a recent tribunal decision, wasn't there, that affected access to air conditioning, is that right, as a result of the list?
Yeah, so as Shan has said, the position of air conditioners as a potential support for participants has been damaged and changed by these new outlists. So in a tribunal case called WVGM, it was confirmed that a standard air conditioning unit is a standard household appliance, and it is therefore out under the lists. The person in that case, you know, there's two options left for them. They happened to be in public housing, and they were told, oh, maybe you could pursue a reasonable adjustment just because you happen to be in public housing. But again, there's no support given to that person to engage in that technical process. The second thing that might be open to a person to access a standard appliance might be the replacement support process, whereby the agency will allow you to approach them with an argument that certain household items have a particular benefit for you. But you have to jump through six fiery hoops, and even then it is at the discretion of the agency. And the replacement support application process only applies to household items. The agency needs to make an amendment to make sure that it applies to appliances, because I see a drafting error in the document that was the legislative instrument that was put through. So there's only a very narrow path to anyone getting an air conditioner right now, when prior to these lists, we had tribunal recognized rights to an air conditioner where it helped you with thermoregulation, where it opened the door for you to inclusion, and where it was key to the delivery of NDIS supports. So there's an example of where rigidity is threatening outcomes for people on the ground.
Yeah, and we know how critical thermoregulation is, and it can force people into hospital. Sam, what is a replacement support?
Thanks, George. So the replacement support is really a mechanism that the legislators put in October last year to enable a person to be funded for a support that's on the list and not allowed to be funded. But you can put in sort of like a special application to have it funded if you can show that it will replace other supports and it will increase your whole independence. So it applies only to a limited number of items, and that's the iPad, a smartwatch, which could include a false watch, and standard household items. So things like some of the things we've touched on today, the drawer dishwasher, a Thermomix, a robot vacuum cleaner, potentially air conditioning as well. I still think there's a way through that one in the tribunal. All of those things you can apply for via replacement support. The big issue with it for participants, it's not part of your plan. It's not part of the planning process. You have to go and get a separate report, put it in at another time. An example I've heard of recently, it also covers apps for communication and accessibility. So these could be apps that you put on your phone, which have enormous potential to, do automation in your home, control your wheelchair, for example. Those are supports you would have to apply for a replacement support. Now, I know the participants I talk to, they don't want to do another form, and they certainly don't want to do another report. And the feedback that I've had from participants and others is that the report for the replacement support will sometimes cost more than the support that you're asking for. You know, if you want an app on your phone that's going to improve communication accessibility, super important for the vision impaired and deaf community, that app might cost $250 to go through a replacement support application. Really a waste of everybody's time when it should just be almost a given, right? It's got a great outcome. And the other problem we have with replacement supports is they're not reviewable, and so they sit outside of the plan. For us in the tribunal, we might be arguing for a particular support which could actually be replaced by a standard household item, but potentially, and the law is a little bit unclear on this yet. I mean, that item is not drawn into the appeal, and so you could potentially get a new plan, and then if you want this other item, go and apply for another replacement support. So the administrative burden, the reporting burden, just the impracticality of it, we're not loving replacement supports, I think would be fair to say.
Sam, what other issues are you seeing?
Yeah, so one of the a really interesting one that's just come across my desk this week is school holiday programs. So the outlist says the NDIS won't fund school holiday programs. So in my mind, as a general rule, a school holiday program is a vacation care type service where there's a required ratio of one worker to 15 children here in Queensland. It costs parents between $30 and $50 a day to send their children to those programs. I've just been speaking to a mum this week whose little girl has been told that she can't go to her program where she's actually supported at a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-3 ratio. This is a little girl, who needs really significant support during the day and certainly could not be at a vacation care where there is a 1-to-15 ratio. Now we can say absolutely, and I think the vacation care should have the ability to support all children. I absolutely think that, and that's where we're missing foundational supports. But in the meantime, we've got little girls at home today on school holidays in Queensland who would desperately love to be out in the community with their friends and doing things, and they're not. And, for that program, the mum said to me, oh no, the planner said we don't fund those programs anymore and they won't be around anymore. So that's really frightening for me, and I think that's really frightening for a lot of parents out there who are looking at that. And I really, when I look at the definition of a school, and this is a lawyer's minefield, right? What's the other saying? Sorry, a lawyer's paradise, or, it's a place to argue about words, but this is real people's lives impacting them right now. So that was the one that sort of hit me this week. And mum was like, yeah, please talk about it on the podcast today. And the other one, again, we're just seeing, just having the rigidity of the rules is really problematic when we have unexpected circumstances or natural disasters. So, we had Cyclone Alfred here earlier in the year, and our service ran a hotline that ran Monday through to Sundays and late into the evening and took calls from participants from around Queensland. And a couple of the things that they were calling us about was, how do I keep, if I lose my power for a week, I really need an electricity generator. This is not just I need an electricity generator because my meat might defrost. We also found just a real rigidity in flexibility in the plan to be able to sort of flex up for different supports that might be needed in the case of a natural disaster. So I think, yeah, there's this rigidity coming into the scheme through these rules, which doesn't have necessarily the best outcomes.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about other things like rent in there, and how, people are doing some really innovative and flexible arrangements with having a housemate, where they subsidise their rent, and then they're essentially able to provide support and companionship. That would cost a lot more if you're paying a support worker an hourly rate. So I feel like the agency is doing themselves a disservice by making things so flexible.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, solutions. We've got to get to solutions. And the thing that's frustrating me at the moment, George, is we're all focused on words on a page. And I think what the agency isn't recognizing is they can send a really, it's a chance to send a really strong signal about NDIS 2.0. In NDIS 2.0, everyone is going to meet an assessor. Okay, we have that wonderful, the disability sector launched the wonderful human rights-based assessment model paper that's really driving at, we want a scheme based on administrative empathy, not boxes, not this type of rigidity. And what really frustrates me about these lists is they're pieces of paper when we need to have human conversations. And why can't the agency meet the person and give pre-clearance for them to get the stovetop? Why can't they sit down and say, right, we see the relationship with disability for you. Here's your passport to claiming this support. Someone in the disability community, a disability legend who I won't name, asked me a question online where they said, this compliance stuff is out of control in the scheme. In our tax system, people claim for work-related expenses all the time. Here we're having a conversation about disability-related needs. Why can't we be recognised and supported for all the way we solve disability in innovative ways? And when I thought about that analogy of the ATO and the agency, well, first of all, the agency is playing catch-up. I began with that. The agency didn't have any systems, right? But the agency has opportunities the tax office will never have, because the agency, at law, prepares every plan with the participant. They will assess every participant in the future. Why are we asking people to lodge invoices and find out afterwards? Why are we asking them to lodge replacement support forms and jump through fiery evidential hoops? Why can't we have on the ground administrative empathy where we say, we see this, we see what this means to you. We see that it matters. Here's your passport to it.
I think that is an excellent message there, Darren. I do want to hear more about what we're seeing in the tribunal as a result of the support list. Darren, can you take us through what changes you're seeing coming through?
So one area that really needs to be solved quickly is the definition of assistive technology. So we've used this label of disability shop, and the drafter is entirely responsible for the dynamic, because the list does not reflect the World Health Organization approach to how assistive technology is defined. It doesn't reflect the principle of universal design and inclusive equality in the UN Convention, because assistive technology is defined really narrowly to be devices and items which are modified or adapted for use by people with disability. The focus, George, is on, does it have disability features? We focus on the object, not the person, which is just never a good idea, right? And what that has led to for real people in the tribunal is the mum of a child with disability who asked for a weighted blanket. And she was told, you are going to have to prove that that weighted blanket is modified or adapted. It was produced for people with disability. And the tribunal said to her, as they're required to do, if everyday Australians buy and use this product, it isn't disability specific. You didn't get it from the disability shop. Now, there are two cases that people can look up. They're my favourites because the participants got an outcome. So there is the case of Hyde, where a visually impaired participant was successful in being able to buy a home automation, a set of home automation devices and automatic gate openers. Sorry, I'm struggling for terms, but you know, automatic gates effectively that would allow them to come in and out of their home without risk okay, and would allow them to move with independence about their home. The tribunal spent pages after pages trying to justify, find a way at law to approve the use of that home automation. Why was it a problem in the first place? Because it was bought at Bunnings and because everyday Australians are seeing a use in the product. Now, I want to read the tribunal member who looked at the words that I, the test for assistive technology, and using as many things they picked up in law school as possible, they found a way to fund this participant's arrangement. But the tribunal member gave a really sharp warning about the text of the outlist and what it is doing to the scheme. I'll just read it out. The definition, which focuses on the nature of the device, what will it do? It means that participants' choice and control would become significantly narrowed, foregoing the principles of accessibility and inclusion as they relate to people with disability and their full participation in life. I consider that adopting this definition would only widen the gap between the disability community and mainstream Australia. Adopting this definition would negate the fact that many mainstream devices or items are often highly innovative, cost-effective, more widely available, and generally more inclusive. Now, what we need to do as a community is change the definition of assistive technology. But how would you fix it, George? It's as simple as a few extra words. Will I read them? All right, I'll give it a go. What you just, instead of, is the item has been modified or adapted for use by people with disability, you just say, the item has features or uses which deliver distinct functional benefits to people with disability comparable with modified or adapted products. And that gets us there. Like when you ask me the question, what's happening in the tribunal, it's abundantly clear that they're just, they're too ambiguous, they're hard to read. There's all kinds of fights breaking out in the area of home modifications. And fundamentally, we need some very strong technical changes that sort of respond, as always, to the needs of people on ground.
President, we've had the disability community call for a principles-based approach. And we've got the consultation discussion paper saying that won't be happening. What do you think? We're hearing the government say that it's the constitution. You're quite well versed in the constitution. What do you think about this argument? And why can't we have a principles-based approach?
So when I read, there's a paragraph in, the paragraph you're referring to, obviously I had opinions, but I did cross the paragraph out and say distraction in the side, on the side. Fundamentally, us in the legal community, we know what the federal government, what the federal government's powers are in the area of disability. They need to be able to show that the spending on NDIS supports is implementing the UN Convention. Now, I can draw lines to the Convention. It's a very boring and technical exercise. Okay. They could cooperate with the states, by the way, to make this a non-issue by referring powers like they did in the area of housing. The answer isn't in the Constitution. The Constitution will facilitate whatever NDIS we need. If we need agreements between federal and state, we could do that. If we need to spend a lot of time having discussions about the UN Convention articles and which bits of the NDIS support which bits of the Convention, we can do that. But I guess, for me, if the agency has an anxiety about what the person is claiming the support for, it needs to step into the room. It needs to step into the room with the participant. its staff will be doing so in the next 6 months when they start rolling out the assessments. And it should run the evaluation on, it should find out what it needs to know. So for me, when they said we can't have a principles-based approach because participants will be on their own, that's effectively what they're saying. It's too complex for participants. I sort of felt like saying, hang on, no. Why don't you pre-clear these supports? Like, if you think there are supports that are on the edge, that raise constitutional questions, tell us what they are. I'm interested in your approach. I didn't get there any answers on that question when we debated back in 2024. But if there are facts you need, find them out. Have your assessors assess the needs for these supports. But I felt it was a very, very negative framing. It was kind of like saying the sector is asking for the original NDIS, NDIS 1.0. We don't want that because we're moving forward with a reform. I think, again, we just take ownership of this and we name every change we want. I think with principles-based approach, like when I talk to people, the question I always ask when someone in the sector says to me, we want a principles-based definition, the question I always ask them is, what principles? And generally what comes back is outcomes. We want to be able to claim things that deliver outcomes. And I guess for me, there are benefits to providing really concrete definitions in the law at a level of detail that wasn't present up until recently, that focus on outcomes. So I'm not sure that we're having a very... I think the row is quite distracting in terms of if we yell principles-based definition, please, we're letting the agency off the hook, is my fear. I think we just name the things that they are denying, name the outcomes that they're endangering if they pursue these lists. And I think we'll get to the outcome we want to get to.
I also think another, in addition to outcomes, is value for money. I think that's a really important, because we're going to have these budgets and we want to make the most of these budgets. And we want to do that by purchasing the support that gives us the best value. Sean, what are your thoughts on changes to the list? What would you like to see come out of the current review?
Thanks, George, and lots to think about there from you, Darren, on what to come out. And I absolutely concur that outcomes is where we need to be. I would like to see, I mean, I think the lists, to be frank, I think probably some form of the list is here to stay, but how they are constructed and with much more pointed definition and with that sort of overarching principle around the outcome for those things, for things that are really going to be cost effective and value for money, provide the support people need. And we're thinking, you know, drawer dishwashers, robot vacuum cleaners, Thermomix, those things that provide really great support, security systems, where someone can actually let a support worker into the house or see who's at the front door without leaving their bed. There are so many things that are just great and have great outcomes for people. So I concur with all of those things. But I also think there's lots of work to do, not just in the rules themselves, but operational guidelines, the price guide, none of which are consistent at the moment and provide so much insecurity and confusion for participants and frankly the NDIA themselves when they're working within their own rules. So it's not just the rules themselves that need to be looked at. There is a much bigger piece there as well about making sure all of the other instruments that are being used are consistent and then that there's proper training rolled out within the scheme and that participants understand where we're going to on this, because at the moment, you know, it's incredibly confusing in this transition period.
Indeed, people are very overwhelmed by these lists, and we need to come up with a much simpler and clearer solution. Sean, I just want to ask you do a lot of work with participants. What advice do have social distance in families who are finding that they're being denied support that they need as a result of these changes? What advice do you have for them?
Yeah, look, so what I absolutely say to participants, and we say this quite often, is don't take what the agency has said as gospel. Get your own advice on whether a support can and could be funded. You have your review rights. It's the internal review. As soon as you've got a decision, if you've got a plan that doesn't meet your needs, doesn't include the things you want, review those through the internal review and to the tribunal. The Administrative Review Tribunal just actually published what happens in the tribunal for participants and for plan decisions. 74% of plans are changed for a participant who goes into the tribunal. So you don't go to a hearing. It is absolutely, if it's a support you need and there's some wriggle room in those rules, that is an absolute option for you. So,
but make sure it's reasonable, right? Get some advice.
Get some advice.
What you're asking for, I think that's really important. And I just want to throw my hats off to all the advocates and people like yourself, Sian, who are working really hard to provide that advice with a lot of very high caseload. We know that you're working above and beyond, so thank you. I want to end with a question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Sian. If you could say one thing directly to decision makers about the recent changes, so both the funding periods and the support list, what would it be, Sian?
Look, I would absolutely say that I think the rigidity and the hard and fast rules are not going to get us the NDIS that Australia has been so proud of. We need the nuance. We need to remember that there are individuals behind every single decision that the agency makes. And I'd just really like to get back to some of that sort of those basic principles of getting results and great lives for our participants.
Absolutely. Darren?
I'd tell them you need to see the burnt hand and the Christmas dinner. So my words are coming from the words of a participant in a case called QDRG, where they were the ones looking for a stovetop. And they have a very limited functional range on their vision. And this standard stovetop would be life-changing for them because it gave an audio alarm when the heat is turned up and turned down. They were also asking for kitchen modifications where their benchtop would be raised. And that participant put in an extraordinary affidavit where they spoke to what that standard, mainstream, arguably banned support means to them. And they said, to avoid burning my hands, I have to cook my dinner item by item because it is only currently, without these home modifications, without the stovetop, it is only possible for me to cook my potatoes first, my gravy then on the same, the one stovetop ring that I can see. The person was shaped by the burnt hand. And the tribunal went out on a limb for them. And we need to, you know, sort of legislate to make this absolutely secure. The tribunal gave them the funding in part because the way the participants spoke about how this support was going to reduce their need for support workers. And they spoke about their Christmas dinner, George, about what it meant to them to be able to cook Christmas dinner with, and it was a phrase I'll always remember actually, privacy and pride, to be alone with family on that special day. And to me, that's the heart of the scheme, and I won't accept that we can't, with good drafting, maybe with some form of pre-clearance, we can't find a way to put those needed supports into people's hands. I think we can.
We can. I think that we've got an opportunity with the consultation right now to tell the government loud and clear what needs to change, and hopefully this podcast has started that discussion. So thank you both for being on the podcast today, and thank you for the really important work that you both do. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, George.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visible and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts or questions in the comments section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.